This is Art Moves, a series of curated conversations at the dynamic intersection of art, innovation, and social justice. Each week, we'll be talking to the visionary thinkers and doers who are forging new ground in the creative arts while redefining what it means to be creative. I'm Toni Williams.
And I'm Eli Kislansky, and we're your hosts for Art Moves.
This program was produced by Art Moves, which is solely responsible for its content.
So, Eli, we are thrilled to have renowned filmmaker Toni Gerber join us. With a career-spanning documentary filmmaking, Toni has brought compelling stories to the screen, exploring the human experience with depth and authenticity. And I can say that's true because I know Toni in another way, and he's an authentic guy. Anyway, Toni's expertise promises to enlighten and inspire. Join us as we dive into the world of filmmaking through the lens of this acclaimed artist. Toni, welcome so much to Art Moves. I've had the pleasure of working with your wife, Lynn Nottage, over the last 20 or so years. And I never had a chance to really dig into you. And I dig you. How's that?
She's also on the show.
Yeah, exactly. But you're phenomenal.
Thank you, Don.
You are phenomenal. I mean, the work that you're doing is just incredible. You know, I know that you've worked, you were with National Geographic, doing independent films there. So what got you into this whole filmmaking creative piece?
My journey was not a direct one. It was sort of labyrinthian, and it sort of followed my gut. My love of filmmaking, I would say, really began with my father, who we lost just a couple months ago. And when I was young, international films were still playing in movie theaters, in local movie theaters. I grew up about an hour north of New York City, and you would see the latest Fellini, you'd see the latest Bergman on a screen, you know? And you could go there on a Friday night and get a bucket of popcorn and watch something extraordinary. And so my father took me as a young person, not even a young man, as a boy, to some of these films, and I fell in love with the form, and I fell in love with storytelling. And so I found my way back to film, initially through theater, and then working with a downtown theater company. I started making small 16-millimeter films for their productions. I made a film for a production at La Mama, for example. This theater company was called Mabu Minds. So it was non-narrative, very image-driven work, which is one of my loves. I'm very excited by the opportunity to challenge form. Right? So when you ask what gets me excited, opportunities to explore form are really intriguing to me. And War Game was very much that. War Game was a situation in which you had non-actors acting. Okay, former elected officials, retired generals, former security analysts, CIA agents, sitting around a table improvising. Okay? And to turn that into a movie was a tremendous and exciting opportunity. When I left college, I came to New York City thinking I wanted to be a playwright. That led me to working with a downtown experimental theater company called Mabu Minds, who used a lot of audiovisual in their performances. And as a sort of a new kid on the block and on the team, I became the filmmaker in residence. And I started making films for various productions. And that was my real first taste of filmmaking. And, I thought about how theater can be more like cinema, right? And that got me thinking about how to scratch that itch further, and it led me to film school. So I went and did graduate work at Columbia as a director and as a writer. And out of that, I made a thesis film that went to Sundance.
Wow.
Gosh, that would have been 25 years ago, a long time ago. But what an experience that was. And very, very nerve-wracking to premiere a film at Sundance as a young dude for the absolute first time. But really a gift and a wonderful experience. So I was plugging away in scripted films, in fiction filmmaking. In 99, Lynn and I wrote a movie that Merchant Ivory got interested in. That would be Jim Ivory and Ismail Merchant. So I directed, and Lynn and I co-wrote this movie, and it went back to Sundance. And it was quite an experience, man. It was it had a young Rosario Dawson. It had Leon from Cool Runnings.
Oh, okay.
You know, but this is really the beginning of my trajectory. This is before I dove into documentary filmmaking. And the thing that intrigued me about documentary filmmaking is how immediate it is. Right. And the fact that, you know, at the same moment in time, the technology became more accessible. The cameras got smaller. You know, you didn't have to know someone with a huge package of equipment and pull a favor. You know, the cameras, you know, three CCD cameras, broadcast quality cameras became affordable and you know, sized such that individuals could shoot on them. You know, and so to make a documentary, you didn't need the permission of a studio.
Right.
You didn't need the permission.
The barriers to entry a lot lower, right?
That's right. You didn't need $1 million. You didn't need the permission of studios. And so there was something very exciting about documentary. And I got tapped to work on a show early on called Trauma Life in the ER.
Wow.
Right? Which was, you know, they would drop filmmakers into trauma hospitals, these hospitals around the country.
It's an adrenaline rush right there.
The challenge would be to you know, find the interesting. So you're casting on the fly.
Mm-hmm.
That's the other thing about documentary that's so interesting, right? You know, you don't have a casting director. The camera is your casting director. So figuring out what kind of personalities pop, what sort of individuals have backstory, have depth, you know? And that was really, that was my introduction into documentary filmmaking. And I fell in love with it, you know? And I kept doing it, and that led me eventually to becoming a showrunner at AMC. I ran a little show about movies and contemporary culture.
Mm-hmm.
And through that, I met a filmmaker named Jesse Moss, who was my collaborator most recently on War Game.
Yeah, we're going to be speaking about that shortly. I can't wait to get into the War Game. But
yes.
Anyway.
Mm-hmm. But the important thing to know about War Game is that we made a movie that was kind of a companion piece. That's sort of a, you know, a distant cousin to War Game. And we made this film in 2007. It was called Full Battle Rattle. And we embedded with a battalion, an army battalion, in the California desert at a place called the National Training Center. And we embedded with these guys as they were preparing for deployment.
Mm-hmm.
There's a lot of young dudes who are scared out of their minds. Mm. And this was an opportunity to sort of, you know, to exorcise the demons, you know, and to work it out. And it was a very intricate game of laser tag, you know. And we had these Iraqi role players, Iraqi Americans playing the part of folks living in an Iraqi village. And so these battalions would have to figure out how to win hearts and minds, how to go in as outsiders with, you know, M16s and Humvees and not scare the shit out of people.
What inspires you? You know, why that particular story? Meaning, what drives you that
so
direction?
I know that you all wanted to talk about how do I find stories that interest me? And I think my answer is, you know, that the stories find me.
Interesting.
I was blessed for maybe a period of 10 years to be doing a lot of commissions. So ideas that came with money attached.
I was going to ask you, how do you pay for this stuff?
Yeah, one of the greatest challenges in documentary, and particularly today, is how to pay for the stuff.
Exactly, right.
I mean, you know, the technology is sized and scaled in such a way that anyone can do it. You can shoot on your iPhone.
Right, but how do you get it to where it needs to go?
That's right. If you don't have an audience, it's like if the tree falls in the forest and there's no one there to see it or hear it, did it fall? You got to get your stuff in front of people.
Exactly.
It's more than just
the
production of it. It's also the distribution.
Yeah. When my heart starts beating, it means that I've found a point of entry, right? And it can be a small thing, right? I'll give you an example of something we're developing now without going into too much detail. And it's about a church, right? And a church that has a history of abuse and manipulation, okay? You know, there's a lot of this kind of content on streaming, you know, cults and all this sort of stuff, right? And it wasn't necessarily initially exciting to me. And then I started thinking about the fact that this is a prophetic church, right? And that the leaders are, you know, believe that the end is imminent, right? You'll witness the end in your lifetime, right? It's the leader is a prophet, right, to his followers. And the idea of visualizing prophecies got me very excited, right? Because it was a point of entry for what I would call a cinematic imagination.
I wonder if this had a date for that, though, you know, something.
Oh, no.
May 31st at 6 o'clock.
No, it's not even set up. You may not even want to get into that. I mean, maybe
No, it's okay.
Probably some of your audience are church folk, and without more context, you know?
But we're talking about inspiration.
So inspiration. When I was blessed for a period of maybe 10 years to be on this, you know, this... I don't want to call it a gravy train, but it was almost, you know, where National Geographic would come to me with these open assignments.
You're listening to Art Moves on WNYE 91.5 FM, and we're talking to Tony Gerber. So, Tony, continue. You're quite the storyteller, but of course you would be.
So the question was, how do I find inspiration, and what are the stories that excite me? You know, and in this day and age... you know, it's not just about randomly picking a story. I think that most filmmakers are thinking, can I get money for that? Will someone underwrite it?
The commercial aspects of it.
Yeah. I mean, you know, sometimes it could take 10 years to make a movie, to make a documentary feature film, right? You know, and it's really important to have an audience because you're not making it for yourself. This is a medium that's about community. It's about communication, right? It's about moving the culture. Right.
So I love that, moving the culture.
Yeah,
oh, wow.
That's right. So, you know, that's always in the back of our minds. Will someone support that? And unfortunately, today, that means that certain types of films are not getting made or they have a much more difficult journey to get to the screen or get to a streaming platform.
Yeah, sometimes we see a lot of fluff. OK,
well,
lots
I mean,
fluff.
The fluff is what's
and horror.
we call it the three C's, cult, crime, and celebrity.
Yeah.
That's what's getting made right now. That's what the streamers want to do.
And it's not feeding us intellectually at all.
Well, I think that this is why young people are going back to the movie theaters. You know, it's fortunate that there are a handful of distributors who aren't scared of... you know, whether it's international content or art film that's not genre driven, but when these films do get distribution, I mean, I've been going over to BAM to see, you know, to the Rose Cinemas lately, because I'm very curious about independent films and how they're functioning in the marketplace, because I'm about to bring one out into the world, and the few times that I've been out in the last couple of months, the audiences have been packed.
That's interesting. So you're almost saying that there's, well, you are saying that there's a hunger for things.
I think young people are, you know, I mean, there's something wonderful about the access that the streaming platforms provide us. You know, at the click of your finger, you have hundreds of choices, right? But those are curated choices.
Right.
And the curation isn't about quality or ideas necessarily. It's about what's going to get the clicks, right? Or somebody's assumption of what's going to get the clicks. So I think young people are hungry for what's different.
Yeah, that's interesting. In some ways, that's why ChatGPT actually is a better search engine, because in Google, you're like-minded seekers in search engine optimization, so you're getting this really curated view of something.
Yes.
Right? But, you know, I think we should talk a little bit about War Game, which is your current project.
Absolutely.
This is your co-director with Jesse Moss, is that you saying?
Yeah, Jesse Moss. Yeah, Jesse Moss. And I made Full Battle Rattle, which I'd mentioned to you about a decade ago.
There's also something you said about it, which I thought was kind of interesting, this idea about gauging with the trauma without looking directly at it.
Yeah.
Could you speak a little bit about the...
Let me step us back and give a little more context.
Great.
So about a year and 3 months ago, Jesse Moss and I were approached by an NGO called Vet Voice, which is a veterans advocacy organization that does amazing work. It's about, you know, when young men and women come home from the wars or come home from deployment. A lot of them are disaffected and angry in some cases, right, because they feel that they've been sent to fight unjust wars.
And coming back to nothing in some respects.
Coming back to nothing, right? And what to do with that anger and that energy, right? And a lot of it is being channeled into far right destructive groups. Mm-hmm. The factor that changes everything is the infiltration by far right elements in the active duty military.
Yes.
At every level of the command structure, right? And so these are folks who would follow the lead of the, you know, a losing candidate.
Yeah. Well,
who, you know,
we saw that. Right. Yeah.
But we didn't see active duty military disobeying chain of command.
Yes.
Military
right.
defections.
And so
yes.
So that's what these generals said. We better war game this to know if that happens, right? And
like
lieutenants and majors and generals start saying, no, I'm not following. This man who says he's the president is not the president. He's usurped power, right? I'm following this guy, you know, who they say lost, but I know that the election was rigged. I'm following him. And these are active duty military commanders, right? And if that starts to happen, how do we handle it? So that premise is both the premise of our film War Game, but it's also the premise of this exercise. So there was an exercise staged in D.C. last January 6th, steps from the Capitol. So we were in a hotel ballroom in Washington, D.C. We had retired generals, former elected officials, security high-level security analysts, folks from the CIA, some names you would know, Heidi Heitkamp, former senator of North Dakota, Steve Bullock, former governor of Montana, Doug Jones, you must know Doug Jones.
I know the
who
name.
Was a senator,
right.
Alabama.
Oh, Doug Jones,
yeah,
yes.
And he was
the
a lawyer,
that, yes,
he prosecuted the Klan.
That's right, yeah. No, he was fantastic.
He brought the prosecution for the—
Then they got Tuberville, isn't that,
yeah. Yeah, that's right,
right.
So we have these folks who understand the roles they're playing, and they're playing the role of a president and his inner circle of advisors, okay, in what's known as the Situation Room, not the Wolf Blitzer show.
Right, the Situation Room.
The White House.
In the White House Situation Room. Sitting around a table on January 6th when Congress's job is to certify the outcome of the election, right, for the sitting president. He's won by a small percentage, but he's won. And crowds begin to amass. So this is all happening. So this war game, which we had access to, took place last January 6th, as I said. What we did is we brought in, we enhanced an understand, we created a fake news network, okay? Which is the way that the folks in the Situation Room, which is really like a little fish tank, you know, they can't see what's going on outside the room, that all this stuff is happening, that the protesters have amassed at the Capitol, that the National Guard has let protesters through, that the protests are growing violent, that there's gunfire on the mall. These things start to happen in the course of the day. And this Situation Room full of the president and his advisors, they have 6 hours to get the election certified or the insurrectionists win, okay? And there is an active insurrectionist cell around the corner in the hotel room. And this cell is called the Red Cell, okay? And these are, and it's peopled by veterans, for the most part, who have made it their business to study the far right. So they understand the playbook of the far right, right? And so what they're doing is trying to undermine the president and his advisors. So we have an antagonist and a protagonist, and we have a goal, which is certify the election. And the fireworks ensue.
You're listening to Art Moves on WNYE 91.5 FM. And we're talking to Tony Gerber, and I could barely get that in there. This is good, Eli. I want to see this.
It's also terrifying.
It is very terrifying, but it's not too far from reality.
You know, we premiered at Sundance,
right? Mm-hmm.
And we had some amazing press.
Mm-hmm.
And some of it has stayed with me, right? Some of it I could quote. And one of the things that one critic wrote, this is the scariest movie of the year. Another reviewer wrote, this movie could be a prequel to Alex Garland's Civil War. So in a sense, you know, Civil War was a great action film. Okay, but folks are like, well, which side was which? What's going on? How did this happen? How did we get into the Civil War? That wasn't the subject of that film. They didn't care, and they wanted deliberately to keep it apolitical, right? Because it needed to play to the largest audience possible. Our film will tell you step by step how you end up in a Civil War.
In some ways, you could say we're almost like at the cusp of a second Civil War.
And right. People have said that,
you know,
some folks consider that to be hyperbole. I'll refrain from wagering, but I do think that this is an extraordinary moment in American history.
But, you know, I was reading in some of the work that I was in my research of you, and it had to do of lack of trust in our institutions.
Yes.
Can you speak about that?
Sure.
Documentary filmmaking shift some of this?
Yeah, no, that's a good question. I mean, one of the pages torn from the far-right playbook is undermining trust in American institutions, right? And so right now, I think it's a third of Congress still maintain that the last election was stolen.
I think they're just saying it. I don't know.
I think they might believe it. There are people who believe this.
They believe it because it benefits them to believe it.
I'm sure there are those who are working the system and trying to kiss the ring, right, and saying what they need to say to stay in office. But then I think there's a good number of folks, a good number of voting Americans who believe the election was stolen. So that, in essence, is the undermining of faith in our institutions, right? And the other thing that's extraordinary that I realized in the course of making this film is just how much of democracy is a gentleman's agreement, you know?
Elaborate on that, based on
tradition and based in norms, right? And Mr. Trump has figured out how to challenge norms.
Right.
You know?
Destabilize.
People might say,
right?
Oh, no. No one does that. Oh, you don't do that. And he's like, why the hell not? You know? And so this is what we saw last January 6th. We saw our norms. Mm-hmm. You know, the certification of the vote has never in our history been questioned. It's a formality.
It's a formality, mm-hmm. right?
Right. But it became a vulnerability.
You know, I think we'd be remiss if we don't talk about artificial intelligence and the assault on authenticity. Because, you know, you used to see a photograph and we'd take that, you know, point blank as that's a authentic document.
Yeah.
Now with like new AI text to video and stuff is like all bets are off. I mean, could you talk a little bit about that?
Well, I can talk about it from the point of view of a creative, you know, of a filmmaker. And it's a tool like any other tool. You know, when sound was introduced into filmmaking, folks were up in arms and said it's going to destroy the medium. But it eventually became embraced, and it became an expansion, another tool in the arsenal of filmmakers.
Right? Another tool, like you say.
I think AI is another tool. I mean, how deep fakes play into political elections. I mean, that's a very serious issue. How AI affects national security, that's a very serious issue. Yeah. That's above my pay grade.
I
can talk as a creative. I can tell you I'm a member of the Writers Guild, and one of the issues we were on strike about was protections against AI.
Sure.
Because there's certain content on television that could be written by AI, and audiences wouldn't know the difference.
Right.
But also, like the camera, shrinking of the camera would also lower the cost of production, let's say, of feature films. Because if once at the point which you can get text to video really be accurate, which is not at the moment, then, you know, you wouldn't need a large stage.
There's set builds.
Sets building.
You know, and location work.
Location
some of that's going to go out the window.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, the pity is, but it's always been this way, right? But I was going to say that the pity is that the aesthetics are driven by the economics, right? That ultimately what is permissible has to do with the bottom line. You know, will the film be profitable?
Isn't that the bottom line?
But that's, you know, you go back to the origins of the medium, the beginning of the early days of Hollywood. You know, it was always about supply and demand. It was always about business, right? And that's a tension that we as Americans and we as creatives in America have gotten familiar with in terms of how to navigate, right? And in many other parts of the world, there are government subsidies,
right?
So it's not an open market. It's not a. It's not the industry that's driving whether or not you have a career. It's, you know, somebody in government who's saying, okay, you know, you're the next Tarkovsky, you're the next Truffaut, you know. But in America, you know, you have a movie that's a box office hit, that's going to determine that you're going to work.
How do we reinstitute, I guess, some of those values that we once had? Mm. I mean, the good ones. I mean, you know.
Yeah.
Right. Is it possible that you could, you know, create
that film? Well, the ability to listen. I mean, that's what our politicians have lost. Mm-hmm. That somehow listening, you know, and deploying reason is like, you know,
ooh, I love that.
A sign of weakness, I think, for some of these extremists. Mm-hmm. You know, that if you're capable of listening and reasoning, that you're not making bold decisions and you're a weak leader. There's a danger to that, and I think one of the things that our film War Game addresses is the importance of reasoned leadership, right? A point that Steve Bullock, the former governor of Montana, makes in our film, it's about leadership. Because when we see him in the Situation Room, he's asking questions and he's listening. You know, he's not banging his fist on the table and saying, call in the National Guard, invoke the Insurrection Act, you know, suppress these riots. He's listening, right? And so reasoned leadership is really, and in some ways it's what you're talking about. Mm-hmm. Now, I don't know that we're ever going to go back.
Right, and it's
days.
Not like going back, because some stuff that was back wasn't always good.
It's about throwing out the baby with the bathwater.
Right.
These folks who say, you know, we have these two tired old white men. Mm-hmm. Why do we have these same old candidates? Why couldn't we find somebody new and exciting?
Exactly.
Right. So there's a danger to saying, okay, well, you know, I like Donald Trump a little bit better because he's funny and he's going to shake things up. And I'm just tired of, you know, the stasis and the fact that it's been this way forever and it's never benefited me and it can't get any worse.
Guess but it
what?
Can. It can. It's kind of like what they, what was it?
It can get a lot worse.
A lot worse.
Than our film makes. And as I said, it's not red or blue. It's red, white, and blue.
Exactly.
Our film is really about fighting to preserve this thing called democracy, mm-hmm. right? And how easily it could slip through our fingers.
Well, I am hoping that this is going to be a tremendous success, and I'm thinking it needs to be in high schools. How's that?
We're getting it out into the world. We're playing college campuses. We were at the Hammer Museum last week in Los Angeles. We're going to be at Columbia. We're going to be at Yale. We're going to be at Harvard. We're going to be at Brown. We were at the University of Chicago. We're getting it in front of college students. We have a strategy for getting it into high schools as well.
Excellent.
And we will be running. At the Film Forum in New York City beginning August 2nd.
Okay. Well, this is exciting, and it's excellent work. It's good work. It's very needed work.
So we want to really thank you for this amazing interview. We knew it was going to be great. We hope you found inspiration in our conversation with the thought-provoking and visionary filmmaker, Tony Gerber.
To all our listeners, thank you for tuning in. For more information, visit us at artmoves.net. That's Artmoves with a Z. You can also listen to us on Apple Podcasts and Spotify. Art Moves is co-produced with Brick Arts Media and recorded at Brick Studio in downtown Brooklyn. This has been Art Moves with your host, Tony Williams.
And Eli Kislansky. Find some art that moves you and share it.